what's it going to take to get more oil and gas industry investment in Alaska? It's the subject of great dispute, political dispute. Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Our guest today was the only no vote on ACEs in the legislature, the current system of oil taxes, Mr. Ralph Samuels. The phone lines are open at 1-800-478-8255. That's 478-TALK. In Anchorage, that's a local call at 550-8422. Email talk at aprn.org. Is the Parnell administration off track on gas? On Talk of Alaska, statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by First National Bank Alaska, working shoulder to shoulder with Alaskan businesses for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And challenging a sitting governor is not an easy feat, but Ralph Samuels is doing it. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Ralph.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, the only no vote on ACEs.
A GIA, actually. The only no vote on a GIA.
Oh, okay. Where did you stand on ACEs?
I voted no on ACEs, but there was more yeah, than just me on ACEs.
Yeah. So, tell me about this. Why did you vote no on a GIA?
On a GIA, I don't think it's a realistic way to try to move forward. Everybody wants to have a gas pipeline. I don't know. There's very few factions in Alaska that don't want a gas pipeline. But I thought this was the wrong way to go about it. It was kind of the government dictating how things were going to happen rather than allowing the marketplace, as much as we're able to, allowing the marketplace to determine a lot of these different factors. And I don't think it was realistic. And quite frankly, I think, you know, in about 11 days, I think I'm going to be proved correct. And you really hope that we haven't taken the last 4 years with a GIA under the Palin-Parnell GIA plan and had the window shut on us. As the marketplace in the lower 48 has changed, the world of natural gas globally has changed. And you hope that the window didn't shut on us for the time being. You know, I hope I'm wrong, but the way things have transpired, I think we really spun our wheels for 4 years and have gone the wrong way.
Well, I guess for the sake of argument, basically we saw TransCanada was the only responsive bidder on AGIA.
Correct.
And that was viewed as, I guess, curious. But Exxon piled on with them. And then BP and ConocoPhillips started their own venture. So, it would seem that something's happening. Something is moving.
Yeah, I think you're going to end up right back at the beginning again. You know, the only thing the state has control over, and really in a lot of subjects, whether it be oil and gas or other investments or just a lot of, you know, functions of government in general, is you have control over taxes. And you have control over regulations. You can't force people to invest money. You know, you have trouble seizing money that has been invested. You know, all those things get to be, you know, a little on the edges. But you have complete control over your tax policy and over your regulations. And at the end of the day, Exxon will have joined TransCanada, and they will come right back to saying, "And now we want to talk taxes," which is where we were 4 years ago, wanting to talk taxes. And you'll have a partner. You'll have this $500 million partner, TransCanada. They don't give a hoot what our taxes are. They can be zero. They can be 100%. It's not their problem. They don't care. So you have this partner who really has no interest whatsoever. You know, we need gas for Alaskans. We need to have stable cash flow from our gas. And we need to have jobs for Alaskans. That's what Alaska needs. And if you look at the companies that have the leases, they're going to want money for their shareholders. They're going to want to minimize their risks. TransCanada doesn't have play into any of these things that we have control over, but now we've got this partner, and as he split up the economic pie, now you have a partner who doesn't really bring anything. They're a fine company. There's nothing against them. It's just the process. We cut in this partner. We're not going to get the things that AGIA wanted. AGIA said we're going to have a third-party-owned pipeline, and the minute Exxon joined into that, and even if you get Conoco and BP to join them, you don't get the third-party pipeline. The producer still will have control over the construction of it, and you have to go talk taxes, and you'll have to ask yourself, what did we need TransCanada for?
Well, you know, I don't want to beat this one into the ground, but I'm sure the listeners are also going to want to bring it up. It's 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk@aprn.org. And Ralph Samuels, Republican candidate for governor, is our guest today on Talk of Alaska. And he's here to talk to you and to engage with you and for you to get to know him and where he stands. But you say, well, we'll know something at the end of the open season, but actually we won't know anything, will we? I mean, I think that's, wasn't that always in the process under FERC that they don't really have to tell you anything? They wouldn't for a while?
In a normal process, if you had, let's say, if you had gas in Wyoming and you were going to ship, you wanted to ship your gas, you're the, you know, the Heimel Gas Company, and you want gas and you want to sell it to the people in Chicago. You would talk to various pipeline companies, and maybe some there'd be a northern route and some would be south. There's various ways to get your gas to the market, and you'd try to work a deal to get the cheapest way. And maybe there's not enough capacity, and somebody has to build a pipeline or expand a pipeline. They would have an open season. The Heimel Gas Company would come, and you would discuss, well, maybe could you do it this way? And you'd start negotiating. The government's really not involved in that. That's the private sector between, other than perhaps the price of the commodity by an RCA-type regulatory agency, like they regulate NSTAR up here. In that entity, that's just a private sector contractual agreement. But under AGIA, we paid half the bill. The people of Alaska paid half the bill. You know, we're a part of this. And if contingencies are put in that gas, so the Heimel Gas Company is shipping gas, and they say, well, when I get a tax deal with Alaska, or if Alaska changes these terms of AGIA, TransCanada has no control over it. They have to go back to the people of Alaska. Well, the people of Alaska should know we paid for it. We paid for this information. We paid half the bill. And starting August 1st, we're going to pay 90% of the bill. Moving forward, it's not a normal commercial arrangement. We chose to go down this road. Not me, but the people of Alaska, through their elected officials, chose to go down this road for the $500 million. We're paying half. We're going to pay 90%. You know, can you imagine, said we're just going to be coughing over the money and nobody knows what we're paying for? I mean, once you get government involved and you want to go into the public arena, then it should be into the public arena. It's not a normal commercial arrangement. I don't think that will happen, but it should happen if Alaskans want to know how they spent their money.
So you basically have said that Parnell, you're accusing him of not coming clean. So what you're really saying is that you think that with skin in the game under AGIA, that he can ask for answers at the end of the open season?
If the government knows, I mean, if the government doesn't know how the open season ended, despite the fact that we're going to start paying 90% of the bill, that's even a worse problem. That was a bad deal. I think it was a bad deal to begin with. That's even a worse deal. And if the government knows, then should the people know? Well, of course we should know. You know, and if Conoco, Exxon, and BP, and the state of Alaska, the four entities that actually have gas, you're going to have to get those four or three of those four entities to agree to ship their gas in a pipeline before anything's going to move forward. You know, you can talk about litigation, you can talk about all these different things, but at the end of the day, there's four things that have gas: Conoco, Exxon, BP, and the state of Alaska. So those entities should know also before they put their bids in. Said, I'm now entering into the public arena. The state's paying for all of this. And if you never told the state, and then can you imagine what TransCanada 3 years from now says when the state's paid for all of this? The state's paying 90% of the bills going forward and we don't know? I mean, I can't imagine entering into a contract like that.
I see. So you're running for governor. You feel that this was a bad road to go down. And now you're also saying, well, you know, it's also very bad that even before the election, we're not going to know how AGIA came out.
Yes, exactly. I think when I voted against AGIA, and I thought at the time, and I don't want to make light of it, but I thought the whole thing was just silly. You're going to end up right back talking taxes again. You're going to talk about the things you have control over. Talk about the regulations and you talk about the taxes. That's what government can do. And as it has turned out, because everything has changed so much, the global market for natural gas has changed so much, the world has changed, you know, I'll make the argument that AGIA could have been, you know, a catastrophe. It's not like the fish plant or the grain silos are those types of things where the government made a bad choice. Here we made a bad choice, and in the long-term economic future of Alaska, it could end up being a catastrophic choice. If we look, if the window has shut on a major gas sale, it doesn't matter, you like it going through Canada, you like it going to Valdez, whatever you like, if the window has shut because the market globally has changed and it is shut and maybe it opens again in a decade, maybe it's 5 years, maybe it's 20 years, if the window has shut, what have we done to our long-term economy, you know, both with, you know, revenues to the state, with people are exploring for oil, because it, the good part of getting a major gas pipeline is that the exploration, if people go explore for oil and gas on the slope, you generate private sector jobs, you generate more revenue for the state through your royalties and your taxes. But if there's no way to sell your gas, then all that exploration, you could picture it drying up, because people are right now, if you go up on the slope and you explore, you find gas, you fire the geologist who told you to drill there. And, you know, then you cap the well and you've spent your whatever, $20 million or whatever on the well, and it's hugely risky. If you have a place to put gas, that's the, you know, the imperative of getting a natural gas pipeline. And I think that AGEA has delayed that, and watching the marketplace change, it could have delayed it for quite some time.
Okay. So how do we get the bullet line then?
If Alaskans are willing to invest some of their own, you know, I believe that the market has changed. The window has shut for a while. I don't think, you know, we're going to be up here with a bunch of gas for all time. But for right now, I don't think that that's going to move forward. If Alaskans wish to invest some of their own, you can bond for some of the money. You can put some cash in. You can get some investment coming in. We can take care of ourselves, where you get gas to Livengood, to the mining district north of Fairbanks. Fairbanks, which is hugely expensive to live day-to-day in Fairbanks. I mean, they're still on diesel power. It is cold. It's cold. It's hot. It's a long ways from any infrastructure to be able to get them. Even, I mean, unless you can move forward with Susitna or Tuckatomna or one of the hydro, but that's not going to take care of the problem, I don't think, in the short term. If you can get them gas, you help the people of Fairbanks. You help the industry north of Fairbanks at Livengood. They've got a refinery in North Pole, which uses oil to refine oil, so the process is hugely expensive. Instead of using cheap gas, they have to use expensive oil. So you look, if the price of oil goes up, you know, that becomes an at-risk jobs and industry for Alaska. If you come further south, you can get gas to Donlin Creek Mine, which is a very real prospect in probably one of the poorest regions of Alaska. You get now that YK Delta. And if you can get a private sector anchor, you know, out, get energy somehow to Donlin Creek, you can then get it to Aniak and Bethel. And I think if you get cheap energy, you can watch the state grow. And, you know, you add on to that, then, of course, you get it down to the Matsu Anchorage in Kenai. You can maybe keep the LNG plant open down there as the gas and cook inlet starts to run out. There's a lot of things you can do if you're willing to invest the money, thinking of it as building a highway. And the government will come in and invest some of it. You want to make sure that the cost of shipping the gas is kept low, so you're going to make an investment. You know, people, the criticism is, oh, Ralph, it doesn't pay. It's like, well, the Parks Highway wouldn't pay if you made it a toll road either, you know, and you would have never built it. So I think there are things we can do to get gas to Alaskans and get energy to Alaskans above and beyond what has happened to the marketplace globally for natural gas.
And just forget about whatever other market there may be outside the state, and let that come when it comes.
I think that the marketplace will eventually take care of that, and you can do some things to prod it along. You know, you obviously will keep engaging with conversations with users, whether they be users in the Lower 48, the companies, TransCanada. I mean, they're all, you know, everybody has their own agenda. Everybody wants to make money for their own shareholders, including TransCanada. But you keep you keep that conversation engaged. But at the same time, if you put all your eggs in that basket and the world has changed, which I believe that it has, we can't just sit back and do nothing, because as the oil declines, we will spend all of the money, and then you will have fewer options than you have right now to keep our economy going.
So what diameter would you talk about then with the bullet line?
Oh, yeah, I think you'd get an assessment of what the needs are for the mining community and for Fairbanks. How fast can they go? you if the engineering works for it, you can overbuild it at certain points where you have pinch points at Adigan Pass or river crossings or something. So if you do get a major line, you don't have problems with right-of-ways. And they're, you know, all of those things are doable. If Alaskans want to move forward with getting gas themselves, all of those problems are fixable.
And then you automatically create a market, I guess, for the gas which is being encountered as they explore on the North Slope.
Right now, the problem with that is there's so much gas on the slope that if the major gas pipeline got delayed for quite a while, there's so much gas you wouldn't need to. Just our royalty gas is too much for just what Alaska needs. You know, it. There's just
really,
not
very, really.
There's
so, not so just even with very, the current reserves. Then, the supply for the bullet line, our royalty share would be sufficient.
Sure, you're not talking about very much gas, which is why, if you wait for the private sector to build something to get us the energy, it's so expensive because it's a lot of money, and you're spreading the cost over a really small amount of gas. I mean, I understand the downsides, and also. You know, I want to make people understand that the downsides of a bullet line also is it doesn't generate cash for the state. You're not going to get a lot of revenue. So as oil declines, you still have to keep your eye on that operating budget. You know, people are thinking that gas pipeline is going to be the savior for the government of Alaska. And a bullet line doesn't do that. It gets energy to Alaskans. I think you can get more private sector investment up here, both natural resource development and other industries, if you can get cheap energy. But the reality is you still have to start addressing the long-term cash flow for the state, which is completely based on oil right now.
Ralph Samuels is our guest. He's running for governor of Alaska. And our telephone number is 1-800-478-8255-478-TALK. When you left the legislature, went into the visitor industry, working for Holland America.
Yes.
So where's the growth potential there?
I think there's two ways to try to help tourism in Alaska. A large majority, I believe it's like 60 or 65% of the visitors that come to Alaska show up on a ship, and. There are ways you want to get more ships up here. You had a big out-migration in the last couple of years. So that's point one. Point two is all the drive and fly traffic. And I think marketing dollars for the state helps the point two. You know, if more people drive up here, you want to get marketing dollars out there for pictures of bears and glaciers and mountains and streams and all of these things and the fish and all these things that Alaska has to offer. To get more cruise lines up here, you go right back to exactly how do you want more investment from a large-scale player is you talk about taxes and regulations. And it's the same thing that government has control over certain things. And the legislature, I thought, did a pretty good job this year talking about some taxes. In the last couple of years, they've done some things on the regulatory side. And so between a little bit of marketing money, not marketing dollars – helps the cruise passengers a little bit, but the cruise lines spend so much marketing wherever the ships go, whether it be Europe or Alaska or South America or wherever, that I don't think Alaska's marketing is going to help them too much. Helps a little bit. Every picture of a glacier and a mountain and a bear helps, but it really helps. The marketing helps on the people that are driving up, choosing to come up here with their families on an RV. So there's two different ways that the state, I think, can move forward with that. And both of those are good ideas to try to drive more visitors to Alaska.
You know, it seems that it's hard to judge because, I'm in the media business. But ever since Sarah Palin got the vice presidential nomination, it seems that, first off, phone calls from Alaska are returned. That's all of us in the media noticed that. But also, the amount of reality TV involving Alaska is shows no sign of that growth.
Oh, sure.
That.
They got the ice road truckers, and they got the deadliest catch. Now they got the state troopers.
Right. It just seems like there's no end of it. It seems like we're getting an awful lot of free publicity.
I think it's all good. You get these like the quirky show, the ice road trucker show, and you get these quirky things, and it adds to the mystique. Mystique of Alaska,
it
and
does.
people are going to want to go. I want to go there. I want to go there. And once they're here, then it's up to us to try to have things that entertain the people, give them something to do, have them leave some money behind. So you can run your business and feed your family.
Let's go to the phones. You ready?
I'm ready.
All right. Ralph Samuels, our guest, and Tim joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Tim.
Thanks, Steve. Hey, Ralph, I'm always thinking that the state could build an LNG plant up on the slope. It would take 10 or 20 years. And by then, the sea lanes might be open, and we could just buy the gas from the guys who own it, who are buying it from us, and sell it on the open market, and then barge it, you know, upriver, up the bigger rivers, and all the way around even to Anchorage. It might be cheaper to move the LNG plant up to the slope than it is to ship the oil down to Kenai to the LNG plant. I just wonder what you think about that.
I think if the sea lanes open, if the ice disappears completely, LNG plants globally are built on gas fields. That's why the LNG plant is in Nikiski, the way it is, and it's in Sakhalin, and it's in Indonesia. You build either fertilizer plants or LNG plants on top of the gas field. So it's a good idea as long as, and I don't know about the state building it, but as far as where it is built, is you'd want to have it there, but you'd have to guarantee that you can get it out on a constant basis. And I don't think that confidence would be there. You can help the villages quite a bit if you do get a gas line of any size, you know, whether it be a major gas sale or a bullet line. You can build a small LNG plant or a topping facility or whatever at the Yukon River, and you just drop out the propane, and then you can have a distribution network to get the propane to the villages. And I think that's been discussed. I know Harold Hines with Angus has discussed that for several years now. So there's various things you can do. The biggest concern that I've got, and there's a guy from the FERC, from the federal regulatory body, and his advice was, and he was in a public testimony, I think, my last year in the legislature, so must have been 08, and his advice was, you need to get that first dollar put in the ground. Somebody has to be willing to invest that first dollar, whether it be the state, in a pipe, in a facility, something to move forward. Because right now we kind of sit here and play chicken with each other. And so far things have not worked out for us doing that.
I think if the state invested in a plant like that, then we would control another element. You were talking about what can the state control. Well, if we built the plant, we would really control a lot at that point. Thank you, sir.
Yeah, thanks, Tim.
All right, Tim, thank you. Tim from Anchorage, our guest, Ralph Samuels, Republican candidate for governor. He's running against Sean Parnell, who is the incumbent, but he came into the job from being lieutenant governor. And there's not a really great track record for people who were lieutenant governor becoming governor, being elected to governor in Alaska.
No, but Keith Miller inherited it and didn't get it, and then Fran lost. Yeah. And I'm not sure how many others, if Cog Hill ever ran. I'm not too sure about the total history, though.
Yeah. So let's go to line one and Fairbanks, where Williams joins the program. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ralph Samuels.
Good morning. I have a question for the candidate Samuels. Republican Representative Don Young has spent over $1.25 million on legal expenses from his campaign to reelection, a fund and a special fund set up for his legal expenses. According to one report, 14 of his either current or former aides have been either convicted, indicted, or under investigation.
Okay, and he's
Mr.
up for
Samuels. Do you support Don Young for his election? Do you know why he has spent all this money on legal expenses? Do you think Representative Don Young has an obligation to give some sort of explanation why these campaign funds go to these legal expenses? He's never given an explanation why all this money is being spent for his legal problems. And on that's the specific question, if you support Representative Don Young, have you donated money for his reelection or his legal expenses? And a broader question is, what is your perspective, and can you comment on the widespread illegality and corruption associated with the Republican Party in Alaska? For example, the six Republicans, all Republicans, legislators who have been put up on charges. Supposedly, there's some other ones that are still awaiting legal action.
All right. Thank you. Ralph Samuels, I think we'll bring that up as a First off, Don Young, and then the corruption question.
Okay. Probably will vote for Young. I have given him money in the past. It's been a number of years since I've donated to. When you start running your own campaigns, your money tends to get focused on yourself. But I haven't really completely chosen with that or endorsed anybody. I've met his opponent is a young man named Sheldon Fisher, who's out there working hard. And I'll take a look. I agree with Young on some things. I disagree with others. I don't know a lot about, other than what I read in the press, on the legal expenses. So I don't know if it's real or if it's a witch hunt. I don't know. I haven't paid a lot of attention to it. And as far as the folks that are in jail, if they did something, that's where they belong, quite frankly. You don't have a lot of control over who else gets elected when you're in the legislature. And there are, the former head.
To give an explanation as to why he's spending all this money on legal expenses?
If people think it's an issue, they won't vote for him. I mean, he'll you live and die with the decisions you make while you're running a campaign.
But you don't think that he, as a candidate, has an obligation to explain why $1.5 million of his election, his campaign funds, are going to legal expenses? Are you curious as to why it's being spent? Do you have any...
All right, William, you're running it. Yeah, thank you, William. You're kind of running it into the ground. We ask him in the media. We never get an answer,
and if people are concerned, he will pay the price. Quite frankly, it's one of the things that I wonder.
All right.
So as a voter, that is one of the things I wonder. I will let you know on the Republican Party, Bill Bobrick also went to jail in the local all the scandals that we had in the last 5 or 6 years, and he was the former head of the Democratic Party.
All right. Thank you very much. And thanks for your call, William, from Fairbanks. Ralph Samuels is our guest. Our telephone number, 1-800-478-8255. Before the break, it looks like we're going to be on gas lines again here. Let's go to John and Palmer. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ralph Samuels.
Good morning, Mr. Samuels. We heard from, Mrs. Palin and Sean when they were running that they were going to get in and they were going to give us the gas line. Many empty promises, which we're hearing a lot of right now, and as voters and as Alaska residents, we want the view the politicians. I'm curious, if you were to be elected as governor, what's the difference that's going to set you apart? I know you're not going to give too much information up because this is a primary election, and you're going to be careful with what arsenal you use. But I want to know what is the difference between you and Bill Walker? What difference are you going to make right out the door to get this gas line, a bullet line, whatever type of gas line we're going to build going?
I think that the if you're going to build a commercial line, if you're going to build a 4B line going to the lower 48, you want to build a 2B line or a 3B line going for export. You have to include all. It becomes exponentially more complicated. You have to start talking taxes with the oil companies. You have to start getting licenses with the Obama administration. Despite what Bill says, you got to talk to the FERC. You got to get a license. You have to start that EIS all over again. If you want to go across Canada, you're going to deal with the First Nations. You're going to deal with the Canadian federal government. You're going to deal with the United States federal government. The only thing that you can do without having to deal with all those complications is you can take care of us first. And if Alaskans want to do that, because it's an expensive proposition. I have no illusions about that. It's an expensive proposition. You can move forward and take care of us first and let the marketplace take care of that. And the problem with gas pipelines, as I got elected in 2002, the legislature knew nothing, and I will pat myself on the back. I know a lot about them, the financing of them, the engineering of them, how the marketplace functions, the politics of them. And the problem with them is it doesn't fit on a bumper sticker. Everybody wants the, Canada my blank, it's Alaska's gas bumper sticker to fit on there. And going to Valdez has huge complications. Going to Lower 48 has huge complications. They are not, it's not an easy thing. It's a lot of money for even an entity the size of the state government, the federal government, or even an ExxonMobil type company, which is the largest corporation on the planet. It's a lot of money for those things, a lot of risk, and right now, with the tariff going to the lower 48, the project is underwater. And it's billions of dollars of losses. So the only thing we can do is, if Alaskans want to try to do something, is get that first dollar in the ground and get the bullet line going. It's the only thing you can do without having the complications of the taxes and the regulatory butter and this government and that government and, you know, the Asian market and all of these things, none of which fits on a bumper sticker.
John?
Okay. Well, I may have caught the show just a little bit late, so... But basically, from this phone call, what I get is that you support a bullet line and gas for Alaskans. Let the market figure it out later, or will come to us later on.
You've summarized it very well.
Yeah, I think so. And the marketplace, you know, there's various things you can do to try to get gas to Alaskans, but you have influence on one of the larger projects. You have a lot of influence, but you cannot dictate exactly how the marketplace is going to function.
All right, thank you for that.
Thank you.
Thank you for that call, John. You got it down into a nut there, which is always nice. It's Talk of Alaska. Ralph Samuels is our guest as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. Crane accidents are on the rise around the nation. Making sure that crane operators are properly trained and certified is crucial to minimizing accidents in Alaska. Equally important is ensuring that riggers and signal persons are adequately trained. More information is available at 1-800-656-4972. Good, safe jobs are Alaska's future. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
It is Talk of Alaska, and Ralph Samuels is our guest. He's running for governor against Sean Parnell, and it's coming right up. The election is in the third week of August, and here we are in late July. Next call from Randy in Fairbanks. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Randy, you're on the air with Ralph Samuels.
Hello. I'd like to look back at the history of 2006. I know that's water under the bridge, but it's good to kind of have an idea about history to see how to move forward. Specifically, the 2006 fiscal agreement gas pipeline proposal that then-Governor Murkowski was putting forward. And specifically, that plan, as you know, had a 20% state ownership so that the state would share part of the risk and therefore lessen the risk on the private investors. It also had an alignment, they call it, you know, a balance from the amount of ownership that an entity has in the gas pipeline compared to the amount of gas they would be shipping. So the state would have been shipping some gas and they'd own some of the pipeline, kind of a rough equalization there. And another aspect, of course, of that was that the shippers of the gas would also be the builders of the gas, and therefore they were very motivated to keep the cost of construction down so as to keep the tariff rate as low as possible, and which is a little different situation than from having a third party builder who is not as perhaps as interested or as motivated to keep the costs down. Anyway, as you know, and I consider it a tragedy, Sarah Palin threw the whole plan out once she got into office, and the open season that would have been scheduled for the fall of 2008 never came about. Anyway, what's your view of that particular plan back in 2006?
There were things I liked and things I didn't like about the plan. I was disappointed that we didn't fix the things that, you know, when we got out to the public and we had a lot of hearings out in the public, there were things that people really stuck in their craw, you know, locking in the taxes for the, you know, the 35 years after first gas, locking in the oil taxes. You know, I had one, there's a real nuanced point here with a tax credit on a gas treatment plant on the North Slope that just kind of struck me as wrong. I thought it should be rolled into the tariff. That's kind of a minor point. But the point that you made on owning the same percentage of the pipe that you have of the gas, so that if there are cost overruns or if something happens with the tariff going up and down, that you're paying yourself. So Alaska would have 20% of the gas, you'd have 20% of the pipe. So that tariff, you'd mitigate your risk by doing that. Exxon, when they joined TransCanada, they made that deal with TransCanada. So they own the same percentage of the pipe that they have of the gas, 37% between Point Thompson and Prudhoe. And all of this talk that, well, we're going to get Conoco and BP to join this effort. And they have both said all along they want the same thing. They want to own the same percentage of the pipe that they own of the gas. And you keep it down, and maybe they shed it after a while. Maybe the pipeline gets built and the risks are mitigated because the construction is down, and then you sell it to a third party because, generally speaking, big oil companies don't like the low rates of return on pipelines. But up front, that's what they've all said, that they wanted to mitigate the risk. And if you look down the road, and if Exxon gets their percentage and Conoco gets their percentage and BP gets their percentage of the pipe, A, you don't get a third-party pipeline because it's still controlled by the producers. And Exxon's already made this deal with TransCanada. And B, you have one entity that has gas on the North Slope that doesn't get a percentage. And guess who that is? That's us. And TransCanada has our share, and we paid them $500 million to take it. And if you get a major gas sale, now that they've cut into the party here, TransCanada's cut into the party, they're not going anywhere. A fine company, but they have nothing against them as a company. They're acting in their best interest. It's the same as the oil companies do. But it is, I think, AGEA oversimplified this. They're still going to try to mitigate their risks. Exxon has already done that. And if Conoco and BP come in, they will also do the same thing. And now you have to split up that economic pie with an extra partner. So I disagreed with some things as far as the tax deal that Murkowski made. There were a lot of things I thought that it was the right – we could have fixed some of the things and moved down the road what I thought would be a more realistic way of monetizing the gas for everybody. I thought it was more of a plan. I didn't like his exact deal, but I think that we're going to end up back talking taxes again.
Okay. Well, thank you. And I agree as far as the oil and long-term oil taxes and long-term gas taxes, maybe the long-term oil taxes was not really the best thing. But I personally think long-term gas taxes, you know, 35 years after first gas goes, is something that is good for minimizing risk for those that are investing in it.
Yeah, I agree. I think the term was too long. You know, when you signed a contract to ship gas from the slope to Chicago or wherever somebody wanted to ship their gas to, the length of that contract, I don't think you should be locking in the gas taxes really longer than the length of that contract, because that's when their risk ends.
I see. Okay, well, thank you so much.
All right, yeah. Randy, thank you very much. Ralph Samuels is our guest. Telephone number 1-800-478-2551. I blew that. 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Email is talk at aprn.org. And I see we do have a one there, but I want to follow up just a little bit. I didn't quite get from you, you don't exactly object to the idea of a different party than the producers owning the gas line. It's just a question that you're pointing out AGEA won't get us there anyway.
If AGEA could get you a third-party pipeline, and the question Alaskans would have to ask themselves, what if it cost you money just to make sure you had that third-party pipeline? Because the people that wrote AGEA, the people that philosophically agree with AGEA, they don't like the producing companies owning the shipping mechanism. Because if you own the Heimel Gas Company once again, and why would Steve Heimel go explore for gas on the slope if you have to kiss ExxonMobil's ring to get into their pipeline? And you would have some pause before you invested your money in the slope. So what we're trying to do with AGEA is they said, we want the Heimel Gas Company to come and explore on the slope. Now, the flip side of that is, if you're ExxonMobil, why would I pay your bills? Why would I subsidize you with what, which is what AGEA does? Why would I subsidize the Heimel Gas Company to come and explore? I've already got gas, and I'm taking all the risk. And that balance between those two points of view is, I don't think we've reached it yet. There was one side that was a little too far on one, and I think AGEA is too far on the other. And you, at the end of the day, you have to have a rational discussion with both the Heimel Gas Companies of the world. Will you come and invest with a gas pipeline? I don't care who owns the gas pipeline, but how much are you willing to pay as an Alaskan from your share of your royalty if, you know, let's say it costs you more just to try to entice the Heimel Gas Company? If you do that and then the small companies don't come, you really screwed up. I mean, really, really, really. I mean, long-term economic future of Alaska screwed up. So that balance between those two various points of view, I think we've gone way too far over the other side. And I go back to what the guy from the FERC said, Mark Robinson from the FERC. You guys had better start worrying about getting that first dollar invested, which we are not worrying about right now.
Okay, here's one that's totally not related to energy.
And I was going to wonder if we could get to anything except oil and gas.
We got one question that goes to a different view on energy, and we have this one, which is from unknown here. More than half of the states in this country have property tax exemptions for disabled persons, including states much poorer than Alaska, which is the wealthiest state in the nation. I was hit by a red light runner, and among other extensive injuries, was left partially blinded. Medicaid doesn't cover eyewear that would enable me to hopefully rejoin the workforce. No one wants to touch this issue. What will you do for the disabled?
On the property tax exemptions, I think the local communities should be determining that. I mean, if the state comes and tells North Slope or the North Star Fairbank North Star Borough or the municipality of Anchorage or the Bristol Bay Borough, whoever, you know, how they have to exempt really their, you know, whether it be for senior citizens or whoever, I think that should be left up to the local governments to determine how they spread their tax burden on property taxes.
Hmm. And beyond that, you got any words on the disabled?
I think you look at programs that work and you talk to that community. You talk to the community of disabled, whether it be disabled vets or disabled Alaskans, and talk to you want to fund programs that work and don't fund programs that don't work.
Yeah.
And as a government, you have to keep a mindful eye on making sure that the money that you invest in any program, whether it be a capital or operating program, actually is addressing the need that's done and is not just spinning in the mud.
Yeah, well, I guess, you know, being in the legislature and looking at the budget, you quickly learned that it can be kind of amazing how little government we have in some areas.
It is a complicated feature, the budget as a whole. And one thing that I think that Alaskans need to be mindful of is, you know, the oil coming down that pipeline at its peak was 2 million barrels a day. When I got elected in 2002, it was 1 million barrels a day. Right now, it's 600,000 barrels a day. And in the last 4 or 5 years, you've seen the price of oil has kind of saved us, and the budget has gone way up. And as you look 10 years down the road, if the oil continues to decline, if you wait 10 years or wait until you really have to make decisions, your options are fewer. With the operating budget, not talking about too much the capital budget, but the operating budget, you have to start looking at you know, the person that wrote the email was talking about Medicaid. Medicaid and education are what really drives the budget in Alaska, and you have to be able to make tough decisions as you move forward with the budget, because in a decade, if you have half the oil, next year's budget balances at $75 a barrel, and oil pays for 90% of it, or 95 or something. So if it balances next year at $75 a barrel, that means next year's budget, with no new scholarship programs, no raises, not a penny raise for troopers and teachers and, you know, DOT workers that plow the roads and all of those things, in a decade at half the oil, next year's budget balances at $150 a barrel in a decade. And if it continues to go up, well, now it's, you know, you can do the math, Steve. You can look up and, you know, are we going to get to a point in the very short run where we cannot possibly balance a budget without, you know, $200 or $250 oil? And that's just not reasonable. There's not enough of us, you know, even if people wanted to say we're going to, you know, have some revenue source from the people, there's not enough of us to do that. So we've got to have a rational discussion on what do we want from our government? Not right now, but, you know, in a decade or in the next 15 years, what can we do now to try to make sure we get there?
Let's go to Frank, joins the program from Fairbanks. Frank, you're on the air with Ralph Samuels.
Yes, Mr. Samuels, Frank here from Fairbanks. You know, we talk a lot about oil, gas, and coal, but, you know, we Alaskans don't have to be dependent on those three, Mr. Samuels. And I'm trying to inform and educate the legislatures as well as governors. You know, when we could have a clean, renewable energy to heat our homes and fuel our cars, and many other products made from hemp fibers and oils can be grown here in the North Star Borough and throughout Alaska. Our neighbors next to us, Canada, 180 farmers every year grow hemp fiber, and so do our Russians and 30 other countries in the world. Bernie Carl, who is the chairman of the Fairbanks Farmers Association here in Fairbanks, Mr. Samuels, recently passed a resolution in support of industrial hemp farming in North Pole and encouraged our state legislature to do the same. Now, I've questioned you about this before, and I don't think you were just informed on it, but there's a lot of information out there on the Internet. You can just hit, Google hemp for fuel or many other products. Right now, 28 states have passed industrial hemp legislation. 16 states have actually passed, but 28 states have introduced, and 18 states have passed. And 9 states right now have lifted barriers for production and research. In Oregon, just recently, the governor and the state legislature passed industrial hemp farming because of the versatility of the plant. And let me point this out. Hemp, and you can do your own information and education, look it up yourself. Hemp is the number one biomass on the face of the earth. It is one of the most versatile plants. And there's no reason why we can't grow hemp fiber here for fuel. And I think that we just need to step back into the think tank once again and quit depending on this oil and gas pipe dream when the real dream can be grown right here in our backyards. And I'm not talking about marijuana, and that's the biggest myth and the challenge I have to get through to most of the Republicans. They don't know the difference. It's night and day. There's very little THC in the hemp fiber. Nobody's going to roll my 55% hemp shirt I'm wearing up and smoke it.
All right, Frank.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Your position on hemp?
I'm not a big fan of legalizing hemp. And when we do talk about oil and gas, I want to make sure there's a big difference. You know, sometimes the discussion is on it as an energy source for Alaskans. And a lot of times the discussion is on a revenue source. You know, it's what drives all the troopers, the teachers, the docks, the harbors, the roads, the whole, everything that government possibly provides. And I'm not, when we talk about oil and gas there, we're not talking as an energy source, but as a revenue source. So, and there's a big difference there between trying to provide energy, whether you can get a Chukotamna or a Susitna or a Bullet Line or, you know, there's geothermal. Those things provide energy to Alaskans and makes it easier to do day-to-day business. You get more investment from private sector for people that want cheap energy, but it doesn't provide revenue to the state, and there's a big difference. But I'm not going to be probably a big fan of hemp.
How about other renewables? You're not...
I think you'd start talking to either Susitna or Chukotamna. You know, you go into the hydro, or I know that you can look at some of the wind generation. I know up in Kotzebue they've got some. Up in Delta they've got a wind farm. In Kodiak they've got a wind farm. I think the government has to be careful about opening up a program that just, you know, everybody that wants a dollar is going to come to the government and say, you know, I'll be the one provides all the answers. They've got to be real. You've got to get your, you know, thumb onto them. And then providing something that provides energy into a grid somewhere, I think, is good, but it's going to be around the edges. At the end of the day, you're going to need gas or coal power to really, really energize Alaska and keep the energy going. You can't keep your eye, you know, or you have to keep your eye on the ball.
Well, do you think that Governor Parnell did the right thing in vetoing the $25 million of the Renewable Energy Fund grants? They basically had already gone through the processes.
I don't know what was in the grants. I know that when I was in the legislature, we funded some.
Yeah, they gave them to the Alaska Energy Authority, and they said, we'll put through $50 million worth, and then kind of sort of out of nowhere, the governor said, okay, I'm just cutting half of that and we'll get the rest of them later.
It's good politics, I guess.
Okay, it's Ralph Samuels, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK. A local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. We got about 10 minutes left as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
It's Talk of Alaska. Ralph Samuels is our guest. He was in the legislature. He left. He went to work for Holland America. He is now running for governor, and he's running against Sean Parnell. Let me ask you this. Parnell seems to be running against the federal government. do you choose to differentiate yourself on that issue?
Not too much. I think that Alaska needs to push back on the federal government. This isn't a Republican-Democrat thing. I mean, it was George Bush with No Child Left Behind, which it doesn't work up here. And I don't think Obama's health care plan is going to work for us. The EPA regulations, which I know that Lisa Murkowski is fighting against, they don't work for us. And I think that Alaska is perfectly capable, as in is any other state. We're perfectly capable of setting education policies, setting healthcare policies, setting natural resource development policies, and we are going to know more than the federal government does, and we can have ugly political fights, you know, Republicans, Democrats, urban, rural, environmentalists, and industrialists, or whoever. You can have these fights, but the fight should be held here on our destiny for how we treat our people, and it shouldn't be something said in Washington, D.C. I think there's two ways you can go about doing it. You can go down the litigation route, which is a long, drawn-out, you know, keep fighting against the feds. And the other way to do that is to get other Western states that I believe have our similar problems with access issues across federal lands, you know, with the other natural resource states, Wyoming and Colorado and Nevada and whatnot, and try to get those U.S. senators and governors to kind of say, okay, look, we're all going to stand up together. We all have the same problem, and this is what's important to us. Because at the end of the day, we're petitioning ourselves. And if you get enough of us together, I think it's an issue. You can't go too much just at war with the federal government. It's a pervasive thing here, but there are ways to push back.
So litigation is not necessarily the way, though.
I think that litigation in some ways is a way. Mm-hmm. I agreed with suing over the health care. We should have done it over No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. I mean, there are ways. There are different mechanisms, both in the political arena as well as using the third branch of government, the judiciary.
So, yeah, so the Endangered Species Act, that's probably going to, you know, continue to be in the courts.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Let me ask you this. Parnell probably is not going to be well supported in the bush. Do you feel that you have something to offer to the bush that he doesn't?
I lived there I grew up in King Salmon. I lived in Nome. I've lived all over. I worked for Penn Air, which is a native-owned small airline, so I spent a good portion of my life in between Dutch Harbor and Cold Bay and Pilot Point, New York, and Port Hyden and King Salmon, and Aknik, up and down the Alaska Peninsula. So I'm well aware of some of the issues right there, whether it be, you know, bypass mail issues, the difficulty with transportation issues. So I've walked a mile in the shoes of folks in rural Alaska, having spent almost 30 years in the aviation community, where our main base customer base was rural Alaska, whether it be the post office, you know, as a freight hauler, or certainly as a passenger hauler, and living there. There's a lot of difference between visiting, you know, rural Alaska and actually having felt the problems that they have and the frustration that they have sometimes with the big city or with Juneau.
But, you know, a lot of it comes down to money. I mean, what we hear a lot in the comments in this program, when it comes to like energy, look, you know, you're putting all this money in this gas line, but what about us in the bush here?
And it's a legitimate point. If you look at a bullet line, the two parts of the state that will have to be addressed, because the gas belongs to everybody, is you'll have to address Western Alaska and you'll have to address Southeast Alaska. And I think in Western Alaska, you can start with the propane down the river. Though I said that Mr. Hines has put a tremendous amount of work into a distribution network. And these things don't happen overnight, though. But you got to get that first dollar in the ground before things start to run out. So you get that first dollar in the ground and you can have a plan. I talked to some of the Fairbanks people about a plan where you have a small tariff on the line, and that tariff goes into whether it be a PCE type of fund or something that can fund hydro projects in Southeast, so that everybody gets, because it's everybody's gas. And if you don't get to burn it in your stove or in your power plant that generates, you know, electricity for you, you get a share of that wealth by going there. You just can't become all things to all people and drive the thing out so much where it costs so much that you can't do it at all, and then nobody gets anything.
What about tribal self-government rights?
Boy, I think you stick to the state of Alaska. I understand the frustration of some of the folks there. There were, if you don't have the money to go around, but I think you're opening a can of worms if you start getting into tribal governments with too much power. And I do not claim to be an expert on there, so if nobody call up and start yelling too much, I'll be on day one here.
Well, yeah, I think it would come down probably a choice of attorney general. Have you given any thought to that sort of thing?
You know, I travel around the state and campaign, talk to everybody I can. I haven't even given a second thought to any any personnel or anything. I talk about the policies a lot, and I will surround myself with people who generally have a statewide view of Alaska and understand a lot of the economic challenges that I believe that we're going to face if we don't start making tough choices right now.
Let's go to Eric. Joins the program from Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with Ralph Samuels.
Yes, I'm Eric. I'm part of the 30% of the state that is privately owned, run business. I've actually seen that through the Parnell administration, ever since Sarah Palin stepped down, is that there's been so many obstacles to that haven't been during this recession that haven't been overcome. I see that a lot of the laws and the state laws are actually preventing people from developing this economy. I was wondering what is the future for if you are elected, whether what you would do to help this state.
Great way to wind up the show. You got about a minute and a half here.
Okay. I just saw a poll recently that said that Alaska, out of all 50 states, was 50th. It was last place on the best places to do business in this country. And that is the thing that has to change. You cannot depend on state government as you look at declining oil revenues. You cannot depend on the government to be sustaining this economy. You have to open it up for investment, not just mining companies and oil companies and large scale, but you have to be able to get investment from small businesses, for people that want to do business here and expand the business, and you got to get government out of their way. You know, we'll have some of the permitting processes I've gone through around the whole state, and you see the frustration in some of these small business, people's stories on, how they couldn't get a license to do this because the bureaucracy would not allow them to do that. And we're not talking about Pebble Mine here or something. We're not talking about it's a flower shop that couldn't get, a DEC permit to do this, that, or the other thing. And you have to change the culture of Juneau to become more of a pro-business attitude, because if we do not, and the oil runs out, and we've become so dependent on state government for our economy, if we become so dependent on it there, it's simply not sustainable. So what I will do is I will surround myself with people and decision makers who are going to look down the road 10 years and say, is this in the best interest of the long-term economy of the state? Thank you for having me, Steve.
Ralph Samuels, thank you so much for coming in. Straight talk. I appreciate it. Coming up next on Talk of Alaska, we'll have a Thursday edition. Hollis French will be our guest. Josh Edge, Paige Corona on the phones, Dave Waldman on controls. I'm Steve Heimel. Thank you.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.